Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight.
Peer pressure. The U.S. announces plans to build a temporary dock to deliver aid to Gaza. But one aid worker tells us that's not a solution. It's a distraction.
Rallying the troops. After a string of violent incidents on New York City subways, the governor sends in the National Guard, which has caught commuters off guard.
How was no approach the right approach? Parents of the children killed in the Uvalde school shooting are stunned by a new report that concludes police officers were following policy when they waited more than an hour before confronting the shooter.
Grouse under pressure. Between the air sac popping and the tail feather trotting, the mating rituals of the Canadian sage grouse have to be seen and heard to be believed. But an Alberta biologist says one more drought and we might not see or hear them ever again.
Total eclipse of the park. Last time a total solar eclipse rolled across the earth, a researcher at a zoo was shocked at the wacky ways the animals reacted. So he can't wait to see what they'll do this time around.
And of all the movie stars, he's the most fetching. One of this year's best film performances was given by Messi the Border Collie, but apparently his people have announced that he won't be attending the Oscars. As it happens, the Friday edition, radio that urges his trainer to please hold. Your collie is important to us. U.S. President Joe Biden is floating a new plan to address the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, floating being the operative word. Last night during his State of the Union address, President Biden announced plans to build a floating pier to help deliver aid to Palestinians.
Tonight, I'm directing the U.S. military to lead an emergency mission to establish a temporary pier in the Mediterranean on the coast of Gaza that can receive large shipments carrying food, water, medicine, and temporary shelters. No U.S. boots will be on the ground. A temporary pier will enable a massive increase in the amount of humanitarian assistance getting into Gaza every day. For the leadership of Israel, I say this. Humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip. Protecting and saving innocent lives has to be a priority.
Today, the European Union, the UK, and the United Arab Emirates said they also plan to test run a maritime route for humanitarian relief to Gaza this weekend. Also today, officials in Gaza said five people were killed when the parachute on an airdrop failed to work. Jason Nickerson is the humanitarian representative to Canada for Doctors Without Borders. We reached him in Ottawa.
Jason, the U.S. president says that this pier will help. The humanitarian crisis still unfolding in Gaza. What effect do you think it will have?
Well, I think we need to be clear about what the problem is here. The problem is not a logistics problem. It's a political problem. So we're absolutely appalled at the lack of humanitarian assistance that's coming into Gaza. Our organization, Doctors Without Borders, has repeatedly called for Israeli authorities to lift the siege and allow humanitarian organizations to bring in essential medicines, food, other essential humanitarian supplies. And so a discussion of a temporary pier in Gaza, which is going to take reportedly weeks to build and implement, is frankly not the solution that's needed. It's going to take too long. And the reality is there are border crossings, including at Rafah, where there are multiple trucks sitting with medicines, food, other humanitarian supplies that could be crossing over effectively immediately. So, efforts to bring assistance in through other means, these are ultimately a distraction from the real problem, which is a blockage of existing otherwise functional border crossings.
What would it take to get more of those trucks moving more quickly?
Well, I mean, as I say, this appears to be a political problem. I think we need countries to be, you know, exerting whatever diplomatic influence they can to lift the blockades and to get these border crossings up and running at the scale that people need, which is a massive increase from where we are today.
Ahmed Fouad Al-Khatib is an American political analyst from Gaza. He's written that this pier would have a, quote, transformative impact if implemented effectively. And he points to the fact that it would bypass, quote, complete reliance on Israel and Egypt to bring in aid, end quote. So even if it's not the immediate solution that is needed now, as you've underlined, do you think it could eventually play a key role, as he says?
Well, I mean, look, if what we're talking about is a pier that allows for aid to enter at scale, then ultimately in the long term, sure, this is a good thing. But I think we need to be realistic about the timelines. You know, we're talking about weeks. Reality is that there is very limited food, water, and other essentials in Gaza today. This is a today crisis, not a weeks from now crisis to be solved. You know, even speaking with some of our colleagues who are in Gaza, you know, we're hearing that our Palestinian colleagues are struggling on a day-to-day basis to find the very basics, you know, clean water for their families. We're hearing that families are having extreme difficulty finding basic items like flour, and that the price of food has increased exponentially. One of our colleagues told us today that 1 kilogram of rice is now selling for $33. So this is an urgent and an immediate crisis that needs a solution.
To your earlier point about exerting more pressure, Biden also said last night Israel has to do its part to increase humanitarian aid and that it cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip for Israel. Do you think that message was loud and clear and powerful enough to affect the kind of change you want to see?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, we have been saying for months now that what is needed is a ceasefire in order to create the conditions to allow us to be able to deliver humanitarian assistance. And, you know, a lifting of the siege to allow humanitarian supplies to come in. And our call for a ceasefire and the lifting of the blockage of access into Gaza is an apolitical statement and call. This is really about creating the conditions to allow us to be able to work, to allow people to be able to access life-saving humanitarian assistance, medical care, and the basics.
Today, the government of Canada, as you've likely heard, made official that it is resuming its funding to UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East. We reported on this and had an interview on this earlier in the week. But as I said, they've made it official now. So between that, what you're hearing, even if you don't think it's the best idea, what you're hearing from Biden, are you sensing that there's a shift and an increased pressure internationally to help Palestinians in Gaza and ease this crisis?
Well, I mean, there is still an active conflict that is happening, and I think that we need to be realistic about what that means for people. I mean, you know, our teams continue to work in Gaza under impossible conditions, under you know, enormous danger. Quite frankly, you know, this is a very violent conflict where people's needs are running extremely high. And so, you know, the scale up of humanitarian assistance that's needed is you know, massive. But also what is needed, as I say, is a ceasefire in order to allow that humanitarian assistance to enter and for people to be given a reprieve from the fighting and the violence that they've been endured.
Does that feel any closer to your colleagues in the field?
I mean, on a day-to-day basis, they're still in it. You know, our colleague describing his family's search for food is talking about, you know, relying on eating food for animals and a real desperate search for clean drinking water and much more. I mean, this is, you know, unlike anything that many of our staff have ever seen. So it's pretty difficult to project, I think, what the future looks like.
Jason, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Jason Nickerson is the humanitarian representative to Canada for Doctors Without Borders. We reached him in Ottawa. Minutes. That's how long Uvalde, Texas police officers waited before entering a classroom where a gunman was shooting students in 2022. But last night, an independent report was released that concluded those police officers did not violate department policy. The investigation was limited to officers who are still employed by the city's police force. It also found that the acting chief, who is now retired, also deserved to be exonerated. A separate report by the Justice Department came to a different conclusion, saying that there were critical failures in the police response that day. Veronica Mata's 10-year-old daughter Tess was killed in the shooting. We reached her in Uvalde, Texas.
Veronica, I know you had a chance to speak directly to Jesse Prado at this meeting. He's the investigator who wrote this report. What did you say to him?
I just felt like I needed him to understand that. How dare he really? Like, how dare he? Can he sit there and say that these police officers did nothing wrong? I did tell him that I felt like it was kind of more of a cover up. They were a pack, and they were backing each other up, and they were making sure that they were not going to be found of any wrongdoing.
You said he wasn't allowed to answer your questions. Did he react or respond in any way? Because you certainly weren't the only parent who had strong words for him.
No, he sat in his chair with his cowboy hat, stoic, never said anything, never flinched, never batted an eye.
What do you make of the fact that it's such a different outcome than the Department of Justice report and others as well?
It's heart-wrenching, you know, because you have a report that has come out from the Department of Justice say that these police officers had failure after failure after failure. And then you hear his report and he's saying that they acted in good faith and, you know, they did what they followed policy. I just don't understand how two totally different investigations can happen and they have two totally different outcomes. Did not do what they were supposed to do.
You mentioned the reference in the report to policies. It concludes that the policies, you know, might be to blame here, that they were just doing what the policies told them to do. Do you see any merit to that argument, that the policies themselves are to blame?
No, because, I mean, what human being is going to stand there knowing that there's children in a classroom and not do anything? You know, I'm an educator. Like, I'm a teacher. And if I see that it's something is happening to one of my students, I am going to go and I'm going to protect them with everything that I can. And that's their job. Their job is to protect and serve our community. All policies aside, they should have gone in and they should have saved those children.
There were some counselors that agree with the parents, as I understand it, that they were not pleased with this result. Is that right?
Yes. No, they were not expecting the outcome. They did not expect what that gentleman said to come out of that report.
What is your level of confidence that if something like this were to happen again, that police would respond differently?
We have so many young police officers now that have been hired on. And I don't have the confidence in the police officers that are still there. If this were to happen again, that they would not do the same thing that they did here. I feel like if it were to happen again, they're going to do the exact same thing because they're scared. And I don't think that they would come and they would help protect anybody.
How do you deal with all of those emotions? I mean, even if you were able to try to put them aside, which I think would be incredibly, I can only imagine would be incredibly different. But as these reports come out, as you have to address them, as you continue to have your meetings, how do you grieve your daughter?
I haven't. I came back to work 3 months after everything happened. And I haven't had the time. I'm fighting for her. I'm fighting for those children, and I'm fighting for those teachers that were in that classroom. And I'm going to continue fighting for them until they get the justice that they deserve. I feel like I can't go down that road right now. If I get to that point, it's a road that I won't be able to come back out of. You know, my husband and I, we're fighting, and we're going to continue fighting for her and for all those kids. And that's all that I can do right now.
I'm so sorry to upset you, but I do appreciate you talking to us today. I know there's a mural of Tess that you and others visit. What do you want to tell us about that, but also about her?
So Tess's mural is, when you look at her mural, it's you've got to kind of think back of when we were younger, and you remember those stickers that were like the little puffy stickers?
Yeah, I do.
So that's that was the inspiration that the artist Anat took in and did her mural with. So all the pictures that are around her are those puffy little stickers, and she is the big puffy sticker that's on there. She was just the light of our lives. She loved playing sports. She adored her older sister. And it's, you know, she's tremendously missed. You know, people say that time heals. And it's harder as the years are going. You know, we see pictures of her friends that are growing up and going on to the next grade level and doing all the fun things that these kids should be doing at this age. And it's heart-wrenching to see. But, you know, we're going to continue fighting for her, and we're going to keep her memory alive and be her voice now.
How do you take everything you've experienced and are still dealing with into the classroom that you teach in at a different school? You're at that school right now. But how does that affect and guide how you work as a teacher now?
I'm a kindergarten teacher, so my kids are a lot younger. You know, these kids are innocent. They know no wrong. And they come in, and I know that the only reason I came back was because I know that Tess would want me to be here. Tess loved coming into my classroom, and she loved helping me. I think she'd be disappointed in me if I didn't come back, and the kids are what keep me going. You know, I see a little bit of Tess in every one of them, and I'm going to continue to fight for these kids because these kids have a right to be able to go to school and not be afraid to walk into their classroom. Feel like somebody's going to come in and harm them. It's hard to explain, but these kids are what keep me going.
Veronica, thank you very much for your time.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you all so much for everything.
We'll be thinking of you. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Veronica Mata's 10-year-old daughter Tess was killed in the 2022 school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. That's where we reached her. Last time there was a total solar eclipse, animal researcher Adam Hartstone Rose wanted to throw his students a bone. They were excited about it, and they hoped to tie it to some research. So the professor thought, why not? They would station themselves around the Fort Worth Zoo to observe the animal's behavior before, during, and after the eclipse. Of course, it was clear to him that nothing of note was going to happen. Animals experienced the sudden darkness of, say, a storm all the time. There was no reason to think this would be any different. Which is, of course, what made it so exciting, when he discovered he was completely wrong. And that's what has inspired him to organize a much bigger study that you too could contribute to during the next total solar eclipse in early April. Adam Hartstone Rose is a professor at North Carolina State University. We reached him in Raleigh.
Adam, what did you find the animals doing during the last eclipse?
We found amazing things. I didn't expect to see anything amazing because I thought that the animals would react the same way they would as if a cloud went overhead or a sudden rainstorm or something like that. But I was actually entirely wrong. Most of the species did notable behavior, notably different than their normal behavior. We categorized those different behaviors into three different categories. The largest category of behavior was animals that reacted in what we termed circadian reaction. So basically animals reacting as if it had suddenly become nighttime.
So they just went to sleep?
Yeah, so they went to like the places where they would be let in for the evening. So for instance, like the gorilla troop usually hangs out on a yard, and then at night they get let in and to be fed and whatnot. And the whole troop moved en masse right as totality was hitting. And then as the sun came back out, they went back to their normal behavior.
Flamingos and giraffes had a very different reaction.
Flamingos and giraffes did. So the second sort of large category of behavior that we noted was what we believe to relate to anxiety. And of course, we can never know exactly what an animal is thinking, but we're really trying to pay attention to animals that seem stressed out, especially at zoos, where we want to minimize the amount of stress that they experience. And flamingos, for instance, during the peak of totality, they kind of bunched up and around the young, so almost like they were protecting the young. And then the giraffes had an amazing reaction. I didn't believe that giraffes were going to do anything very interesting. So prior to our study, somebody had witnessed giraffes running around on the Maasai Mara in Africa during an eclipse that happened many years ago. And I thought that was just sort of a random sort of anecdotal experience. But it turns out that a couple of the giraffes at Riverbanks did the exact same thing. Mm. So they looked very freaked out.
Oh, no. And what did it take to calm them down?
When things return to normal, they calm down. And so we're not sure if they were reacting. Unfortunately, it's hard to know. Were they reacting to the eclipse itself? Or the other thing that they could have been reacting to was the very weird behavior of the people. So people were doing weird things during the eclipse. And
what is
happening? Animals can really pick up on that kind of thing.
They sensed something was amiss in addition to what they were seeing or not seeing at that time. A lot of this, you know, seems, it doesn't surprise me too much in that you know, there might be some strange behavior. But the Galapagos tortoises, as I understand it, started to mate.
Yeah. So the third category of reaction that we had to the eclipse was other and like novel, I think we termed it. And it was just like, we don't know what to do with it. And two species had really interesting reactions. So the Galapagos tortoises, that during, as the eclipse was building, they became more active. And then right at the peak of totality, they started mating behavior, which is pretty amazing. And it's funny to think about an animal that's as long lived as a tortoise, like maybe it is triggered by very bizarre, rare weather events, something that we would experience only once in a lifetime. You know, maybe they experience eclipses more regularly than that.
Well, you know, whatever works.
Whatever works.
Whatever works.
I didn't find it very sexy, but maybe that's what does it for a tortoise.
You're not a tortoise. Yeah, I checked. Right. What are you hoping to see this time around, Adam?
This time around, we're hoping to see some of the same. So some of what we want to do is try to confirm some of the really strange things that we observed. So, for instance, I'm hoping that people will send us information about Galapagos tortoises at other institutions and see if they have that same reaction. We're also going to be watching similar species. So, for instance, I'm going to be watching some other giant tortoise species at a different zoo in April. And then we're hoping to look at other whole types of categories of animals. So, for instance, I'm hoping that people send us data from other zoos, but I would love it if people were looking at farm animals, for instance, or out in the wild and looking for squirrels or birds or deer. And then I'm really excited about all of the data that I think we're going to get from people just observing their pets.
Yeah.
Everybody's really interested in what dogs might do during an eclipse. And we did a pilot study, actually, during the annular eclipse in October, and we got a lot of great feedback about what people thought was going on with their dogs.
And the researchers, you, everyone, should be wearing, you know, protective gear on their eyes, certainly. But are the animals in any danger here?
That's a great question. A lot of people are super concerned, like, should I be making my dog wear glasses during an eclipse? And as I say, as I've always explained, the truth is animals know better than to look at the sun. So it's really important that we remember that we should never look directly at the sun.
Yes.
But that's not a problem that I think animals have. And so I don't think anybody needs to be worried about it. Now, if you would like to put glasses on your dog for a fashion statement, I'm fully in support of that. But no matter what, it's going to be an exciting experience.
I think you're right. Adam, thank you.
Thank you.
Adam Hartstone Rose is a researcher at North Carolina State University. We reached him in Raleigh. And if you want to contribute your observations, you can do that at solareclipsesafari.org. For years, casting people saw an actor who was too offbeat, too intense, too much. Then he got his first big break, and he grabbed it like a tennis ball and never let go, even if you said, drop it. I can't throw it again if you don't drop it. Now he's rubbing elbows. He does technically have elbows with the fanciest Hollywood stars at big events, most of whom have found him delightful, but a few of whom have unfairly complained that he is not, despite all the evidence, a good boy. In the months since Anatomy of a Fall was released, one of its lead actors has become a star himself, thanks to scenes like this.
Viens, viens, Snoop, viens. Viens, voilà, viens, 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 c'est le sécheuse. Tu te comprends, quoi. Il n'y a plus de saleté. Allez, c'est presque fini.
He shakes to dry himself off and then subtly expresses his distaste for an instrumental version of 50 Cent's P.I.M.P. And later on, his performance is as harrowing as anything in any other Best Picture nominee, except worse, because he's a dog. Massey is also the talk of Hollywood, partly because of his work in that movie, which won him the coveted Palme d'Or Award at Cannes, and partly because of his attendance at the lunch for Oscar nominees, where he charmed the likes of Ryan Gosling, Billie Eilish, and Bradley Cooper, but also made powerful enemies who whined that allowing him to attend the lunch gave Anatomy of a Fall an unfair advantage with voters. Well, congratulations, haters. Today we learned that Messi will not be attending the Oscars. No reason was given, but I assume they're appeasing the whiners. It's not sad for Messi, who does not know or care at all, but sad for us. All we wanted was to gaze on an artist whose future nickname will be Sirius because he is the dog star.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
New York City commuters don't take kindly to delays, so they have been pushing back, but so far New York Governor Kathy Hochul is not budging. This week the governor announced plans to deploy hundreds of National Guard soldiers in New York City's subway system. As of yesterday, they were already patrolling platforms and assisting with bag checks. The purpose of the plan is to make people feel safer, but many say it does the opposite. Shekhar Krishnan is a New York City Council member representing part of Queens. We reached him today in Albany, New York.
Council member, when you see these troops standing in your city's subways, stations, what signal does that send to you?
Well, I think it is frankly ridiculous to have the governor placing the National Guard in our New York City subway systems. If we really want to prioritize safety and we really want to make sure New Yorkers are safe, and that has to be our top priority, then we have to actually invest in the strategies that truly keep people safe, like mental health services, like services for our homeless population. But putting the National Guard in our subway system only contributes to fear-mongering. It heightens the sense of fear and lack of safety,
which is exactly the opposite of what I would hope the governor is trying to do. And on top of that, it only increases the further over-policing of black and brown New Yorkers.
The governor has said that this is just one prong in a multi-pronged plan, and that people are misrepresenting. That's not a quote from her, but, you know, not talking about the comprehensive plan that she's rolling out. She's saying it's going to roll out in phases, that it will include $20 million for mental health teams on the subway, in the system there. So she hears you, and she's saying this is about keeping New Yorkers safe as well. So does that ease your concerns at all? This is one piece of the plan?
No, it doesn't, because I failed to see how placing the National Guard is a component of a strategy to keep New Yorkers safe. The fact of the matter is, even with the resources the governor is allocating towards mental health services, some of these resources of this overall comprehensive strategy are being directed towards placing the National Guard here. And those are resources that could be used to further increase the resources she's allocating for mental health services. So by diverting resources for the National Guard, you're actually taking away from more that could be spent investing in mental health services. We have a mental health crisis in our city that we need to fix by transformative investments in mental health services. We have a housing crisis in the city. We need to fix it by transformative investments in services for our homeless and for housing.
Why do you think she's doing this, Ben?
You'd have to ask the governor. I have no clue. But my real concern is that this only heightens a sense of a concern about lack of safety. It only plays into fear-mongering by those who want to make New York feel unsafe. It doesn't actually address the problem. What we need to do is make sure New Yorkers truly feel safe. Putting the National Guard in the subway system will not make New Yorkers feel more safe.
Crime is down overall, but there were incidents in January and February, and specifically in January, incidents, according to police data, were up 47% from the same time last year. And there were some very publicized, very violent incidents that could contribute to that fear even before the National Guard set foot in the subway. So what do you say to people who have been saying, you know, I'm glad to see them, this does make me feel safer right now?
Well, the first thing I would say is that if we want to, if crime is down, first of all, at this point, which is true, then putting more towards policing and towards the National Guard, I fail to see how that is necessary in this moment. Number two, as we know, if we truly want to make New Yorkers feel safe to prevent crime, then we have to actually address it with preventative strategies that address the root causes of issues that create instability and can lead to crime in the first place. By the time, oftentimes, police are called, by the time a military presence like the National Guard comes in, it's often too late. It's a reactive measure.
You're certainly not the only critic of this plan. Criticism came in quite quickly after it was announced. Given the response, have you heard anything, you know, or a sense that something might shift from the governor's office?
I've heard nothing so far. I would hope that the governor, would expect the governor to be listening to New Yorkers, New York elected officials like myself, when we communicate that the real needs that we have are for more transformative investments in mental health services, in housing.
Will that other piece that we talked about a moment ago, the $20 million that she's promising to get mental health teams in the subway, how would you like to see that rolled out? Because that does speak to one of the things that you're saying. So what would make you feel that part of it would be effective?
Well, you know, I think from a baseline level, I would just say, I think it's a good thing that the governor is investing $20 million in mental health services. Of course, increased resources is important. But $20 million pales in comparison to what the real needs are. You know, as I was saying, we have not invested in, as a state, as a city, in mental health services at the level that we need to. We have not really prioritized supporting mental health service programs and other resources as the way that we should. That's the real crisis that we face. And so a $20 million investment, I'll never say that, you know, putting money towards it is not good. Of course it's good, but it's not enough.
What are your constituents telling you about this move, the National Guard, in their subway stations? You must be hearing a mix of responses, no?
Yes. No, for by and large, you know, here's the number one thing. Every New Yorker wants to feel safe walking down the street, riding the subways, safe from hate crimes. That's what all my constituents tell me. And what they want to have prioritized are investments and strategies that truly make them feel safe in those situations. But my constituents also don't see how having the National Guard in the subway is going to improve their safety or make them feel more safe.
Do you feel safe on the subway, Council Member?
I feel safe on the subway, yes. And I think there are a lot of New Yorkers who do. And part of this is there's a lot of fear-mongering that is contributing to a concern that our subways are less safe than they actually are. There's no doubt there are things to address, but the things to address are getting individuals who need help, help. Getting individuals who need mental health services, those services. And getting individuals who need housing, who are homeless, whether in our subway system or on the streets, getting them dignified, permanent, and affordable housing.
Council Member, thank you for your time.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Shekhar Krishnan is a New York City Council Member. We reached him in Albany, New York. Biologists in Saskatchewan and Alberta are warning that one of Canada's great natural sounds could soon fall silent. It goes like this. The sound of a male sage grouse engaging in one of the most spectacular and spectacularly odd mating rituals this country has ever known. He's strutting around a special natural dance floor called a lek, where he puffs up these big air sacs on his chest. And then he expels the air to make that sound you just heard, all in the hopes that a female grouse will take interest. And the grouse courting season is almost here, but a new census from the province of Alberta is raising questions about the future of the bird in this country. Mark Boyce is a professor of wildlife biology at the University of Alberta. We reached him in Jasper National Park.
Professor Boyce, it all sounds a little bit like a ringtone to me, but for people who haven't heard it, haven't seen them in action, can you describe what's happening and what you think makes them so special?
Well, those are booming calls of the male sage grouse, and they puff up their air sacs. They have these bright yellow air sacs with a white feather background, and then they lift up their wings, and then when they drop their wings, the air sacs collapse, and it creates that bubbly sound. And there's also a little swish that you might have noticed at the end of each of those bubbly sounds, and that's the wings coming back down, and a little bit of a vocalization that they make. But it's all those pieces are really important to the females, who are very selective about which males they're interested in,
as they should be. And do they like that sound?
Oh yes.
But they're in a bit of trouble, and I know you're concerned about them. How many of them are left?
Well, in Alberta, we have 18 males as of last year. We have 18 males, and typically there will be at least one female for every male, and sometimes as many as two females per every male. So our guess is that they're probably between 40 and 50, 50 at the most. Sage grouse in Alberta. There's only one lek remaining in Grasslands National Park in Saskatchewan. The numbers are desperately low, and you know, in the 1960s, early 70s, we had 2,000 to 3,000 of them, and there was a hunting season for them into the 80s. But the numbers just kept going down.
What's made them so vulnerable?
Oh, they're very sensitive to human development and disturbance. Pump jacks, for example, on oil wells, they'll avoid those out to about 2 kilometers. They avoid roads. They avoid power lines because eagles will perch on them, on power poles. They're afraid of everything, and they're very secretive birds most of the year. But mm-hmm. When the males are on the lek, they're very conspicuous.
You were part of a lawsuit that working to try to save the habitat of the sage grouse. What happened there?
So in 2008, the federal government came out with a recovery plan So this was Department of Environment. The recovery plan failed to identify critical habitat for the greater sage grouse. And we had published in a peer-reviewed journal the characteristics of, in some detail, with a resource selection function model and so forth. And we'd mapped out critical sage grouse habitat in Alberta. But the federal government failed to identify critical habitat. And so EcoJustice contacted me and asked if I would participate in a lawsuit. And after getting the blessing of my department chair, we went ahead and sued and won that they had failed to identify critical habitat. And so they hired a team of people to do this kind of work across Canada. But that didn't slow down the provincial government of Alberta from permitting oil and gas leases right in the middle of critical habitat.
So you were part of a lawsuit to try to save their habitat.
Yep.
You won that suit.
Yep.
But ultimately it didn't work. And you're saying that the province bears some of the responsibility.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. 100%. They continued to develop and disturb areas that are critical sage grouse habitat, mostly for oil development. And so then we went into a petition for an emergency protective order. And a new minister came on. Her name was Oglukic. And within 2 weeks, she issued the emergency protective order. Mm-hmm. And that's what was necessary to prevent further erosion of habitat.
So what's the status now?
Well, the habitat has already been fragmented and chopped up, and there are still pump jacks out there and other forms of disturbance. And the birds are in desperate trouble, especially given that we're expecting drought conditions to emerge this summer, and that could be the death knell for drought in Canada.
What happens if it is the death knell, as you say?
Well, the way that it's going to play out is that if we have drought conditions, there won't be sufficient vegetation surrounding the nest sites to be able to protect the hen on the nest, and it exposes them to predation. And so that would be my expectation, is that drought conditions would increase predation at the nest. And then likewise, conditions might be pretty tough for the chicks during the summer.
So what needs to happen to protect them further?
Well, I think removing infrastructure such as pump jacks and power lines that go into those pump jacks, removing fence lines, other kinds of features that are a threat to sage grouse would be a step in the right direction. The most important thing is habitat. You know, they've tried to supplement the population with captive birds and birds from Montana, and that's just been unsuccessful. It won't work unless we have the habitat.
Professor Boyce, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Mark Boyce is a professor of wildlife biology at the University of Alberta. We reached him in Jasper. Like most teenagers, Kieran was preoccupied with whether she would ever fall in love. But unlike most teenagers, she was preoccupied with something else, too, how she would tell any of her admirers about her past. She talks about that in the documentary To Kill a Tiger, which tells the story of how she was beaten and raped by three men in April 2017 when she was 13 years old. Kieran was at a wedding in her rural village in the eastern Indian state of Jharkhand at the time, and what followed that horrific crime was a public fight by her father, who sought justice for his daughter in a context where compromise with rapists is encouraged. Kieran is now 20 years old, and Kieran is not actually her name. It's been changed at her request. She and her family will be watching the Oscars this Sunday to see if To Kill a Tiger wins the Oscar for Best Documentary Feature Film on Sunday night. Toronto-based filmmaker Nisha Pahuja is the director. She joined Neil in the As It Happens studio recently for a feature conversation about the film.
Nisha, welcome to the As It Happens studio, first of all.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here.
It's great to have you. You know, when you watch the film, it's certainly one thing to see the courage of Kiran, just a young girl, young teenager on screen. But in person, what did that feel like to you to see that?
Yeah. You know, I'll be really honest. I think for me, over the course of, because the trial took place over 14 months, the case expanded 14 months. And I think for me, before the day that she testified, I think the thing that I always felt was anxiety and concern. And
from her and for her?
Both.
Yeah.
Yeah. And tenderness, you know, towards her. And it wasn't until the day that she was testifying, it wasn't until that moment that I really saw just how incredibly brave and how courageous she was. And you remember the moment in the film where she, you know, just walks down the hallway before she's walking into the courtroom. Mm-hmm. And then she comes out. And it was at that moment, you know, where I thought, oh, this, she's really, really something. And of course, the family spoke to me about it. You know, her father spoke to me about it a lot, her bravery. And, you know, as he also says in the film, like, if she has this kind of courage as somebody who's so young, like, of course, I'm going to keep fighting, right? Like, she says to him at one point, I'd rather die than give in. And so that's pretty extraordinary. And you obviously feel her courage in the film in that main interview as well that we did. But that interview, to be very honest, that interview was done after the case was over because I didn't want to traumatize her in any way. I didn't want to put any kind of pressure on her. So, you know, obviously, we see her courage in that interview as well.
I want to talk about how you decided when to interview her and those aspects of the craft of making this difficult film and powerful film. But those comments, including the one you just mentioned, I'd rather die than give up. But throughout the film and in that interview, you talk about she just drops these lines, these bits of wisdom that would be remarkable for anyone to say, let alone someone who has been through sexual assault and something so traumatic in a place like where she lives, but also because she's so young. Where do you think that wisdom and strength comes from?
I have no idea. It was always so stunning to me. And, you know, he had it too, right? Like Ranjit.
Still power.
Yeah, he has it as well. There's a certain kind of ethical conviction. And, you know, obviously she must get something from him, right? That sort of philosophical underpinning, right? And I think with him, you know, Ranjit was raised, this is something we didn't get into in the film, but, you know, he was actually raised by a single mother. He didn't have a father growing up. So I think seeing what his mother went through, the struggle that she endured, I think definitely had an impact on how he saw women and girls. But more than that, I think he was just born with a certain kind of nature and a certain kind of conviction and strength. And I think that may have gotten passed down, right, to her, especially because she was so beloved by him.
Which he says right away, that kind of father's love, but also a certain kind of heart.
Yes,
and his wife too, Kiran's mother. She's very quiet throughout, and I wondered, will we hear her speak? Is there a reason she's not speaking? And then when we do,
yes, watch out.
Yeah, to her husband, to officials. Yes. So you see that family dynamic and environment. Yet it's so rare when you talk about Ranjit and men. Initially, this film wasn't going to be this film. Yeah. You were going to focus on masculinity and that issue and the NGO that we see in the doc, which is they're crucial to this case going forward as well, and making sure the family stays with it. But when did things shift? How did you go from that plan to where you ended up?
Well, it shifted actually after 2 years of being in the edit room and kind of banging our head against a wall and thinking, why on earth isn't this, you know, brilliantly sort of abstract conceived idea, you know, of making this film about masculinity and kind of, you know, combining these three storylines, right? Because I'd been filming for 3.5 years. And as you said, the focus was completely different. And Ranjit's story and the story of his family was going to be the sort of spine of a larger film that I was making on masculinity, you know, and I really thought it was a great concept. But it wasn't working. And we were really trying to make it work, myself and my editors, Mike Mann and Dave Casala. And then we showed the cut. We had this sort of five-hour assembly, and we showed it to a few other people that we really trusted. And they both said, you have two separate films in your material, and you need to pivot. Interestingly enough, I think in a way, I think we were supposed to take this long, because what happened over the course of making the film is she became an adult. And because she became an adult, she could decide to come forward, you know, and be seen. And that's what she did.
As you're watching it and as you were shooting it, I mean, there are these beautiful angles and moments. You know, she's tying the beautiful ribbons in her hair, which we see so often, and the braids. So at that point in the film, as I was watching, I thought, you know, we know the family, we know, you know, the name they've given her for this documentary, but we won't actually see her. And I think it could have still been quite powerful just hearing her. But when she told you, I'm ready for this, what did that mean to you?
Oh, my God. I'll tell you just the process of it. So our sound recordist, who's based in Bombay, Anita, she flew to Ranchi. It was the fine cut of the film at the time. And she flew to Ranchi and she showed the family the film. And with the, you know, the idea in mind that if she was okay with it, she would say, yes, we can, you know, you can show me. And so we had this long conversation on Zoom beforehand. And I said, like, if it's too much, we can turn it off. Don't worry. And we'll do whatever you want. It's, you know, just know that we're here for you. And so I was like, pins and needles for two hours, you know, while they were watching it. And then I Zoomed them once it was over. And just the look on their faces, each one of them, you know, just this kind of like lightness. It was so powerful. And as soon as I saw their faces, I just thought, oh, they love the film. And she was beaming. And then I spoke to her the next day because I wanted to have a private conversation with her. And I said, you know, tell me why. Like, why are you choosing to come forward? Because it's rare and it's unusual. And she said that she felt two reasons. One, that, you know, obviously speaking out meant that other survivors would come forward, you know, that it was important to sort of remove this from this idea of it's shameful and a survivor's fault. But she also, for herself, wanted to celebrate her courage. And she said that she couldn't believe her own strength as a 13-year-old child. She was crying and she was saying, I don't know where this came from, where this strength came from, but it's there. And I want the world to know how strong I was.
Remarkable.
Yeah.
How rare she is, as you talked about, in terms of these kinds of stories, the fact that she had the strength to come forward. The other thing that the film underlines when we talk about rareness is that her father is standing up for her throughout this. Describe the dynamic in these sorts of situations usually, and why Ranjit stood out to you right away.
Well, I mean, just, you know, the fact that he went to the police right away, because oftentimes these things are just resolved or they're, you know, they're kind of put under the rug. Or, you know, in this case, there was the Mukhiya, who was kind of the regional chief of these 10 villages. And he had actually, interestingly enough, just a few months before then, there was another case of sexual assault, and he had managed to suppress that. So there was an awareness that was just kind of what happens. Mm-hmm. And Ranjit refused, outright refused, and went to the police. And I think for me, it was, you know, in the film, that scene where Amit is going to meet him for the first time, that's literally the first time we ever met him. I mean, literally the first time we met the family is with our camera,
This is the aid worker activist from the NGO that comes into the village to give people advice and support.
Yeah, yeah. So the first time we met the family is the first time, you know, filming with them, and the first time Amit, the activist, is meeting with them. And then the very next... our very next shoot with the family was that interview that you also see in the film. And when he talked about, like, the moment that he said, I wanted a girl, like, when my wife was pregnant, I kept saying, I want this to be a girl. And his wife was saying, no, it's going to be a boy. Mm-hmm. And as soon as he said that, I thought, this is a very unique and special man. an unusual man because, you know, I don't know how much you're aware, but this idea of kind of, you know, the skewed gender ratio in India and the preference for sons. And here's this man saying, I wanted a daughter. And I thought, this man is, he's not cut from the same cloth, you know? So I knew he was very, very special for sure.
And in ways big and small, he pays for that in the film as you go throughout and as the case weaves its way through the courts. What is not rare in India, as you well know, and we see through the film, but for our listeners, the statistics discussed in your film say that an estimated 90% of rapes go unreported in India. A reporter in the piece at that time says a woman is raped every 20 minutes in India. From the activists and the advocates you spoke with, you know, they do talk about this new law. Did mm-hmm. that actually help shift things?
Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah, without a doubt. There's two parts to this. I mean, you know, after the Delhi gang rape, there was a real strengthening of laws in India. You know, they became quite robust. And the POXO Act, which is, you know, the act that governs sexual offenses against children, also has a lot of, you know, it's very strong teeth. So that definitely played a part here. The issue in India, and this might be sort of the issue in many countries around the world, it's not so much the laws, it's the implementation mm-hmm. of the laws. And it's the systems that survivors have to navigate that are not sensitized to what it means to experience sexual violence and what a survivor needs. So that's really the key issue, and that, I think, transcends borders.
We see, though, even from the villagers, they don't care what law is on the books. They're saying this should be decided in the village. They say it to them, to their face, repeatedly. They encourage compromise, as our listeners heard in the introduction. And compromise means you should just marry one of them. Why wouldn't you? You know, this idea of that she is stained comes up. How often is that community aspect impacting what these young women do?
Mm-hmm. It's really hard for me to kind of generalize. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, one of the things that I kept trying to get from the NGOs is how common is this idea of marrying your rapist? Mm-hmm. Which, interestingly enough, you know, people should know that there are 20 countries around the world where it is, you can't escape punishment by marrying
this
your
This is not only an
victim.
India problem by mm-hmm. any means.
Yeah. Although in India, it is against the law, you know. So it was hard for me to know how common that idea was. What is, I think, very prevalent, and again, it's all over the world, is this idea of shame, of somehow, if you're a survivor, you're to blame. You've done something wrong. You asked for it. Maybe it was something that you wore. Maybe you gave them the wrong signal, right? I mean, I think that is something that's common around the world. I think for sure, the stigma in India is very, very strong. It's very strong.
That shame and blame, it's interesting. Ranjit feels it. Her father feels it and talks about it over and over again. And it's interesting. I wonder for you, as you watched it, everyone is being blamed except the three rapists. Yes. And you are asked to weigh in sometimes as you're interviewing people. You must have had very strong reactions, but you had to be restrained, I'm sure.
Actually, I didn't really have strong reactions. What I felt was a deep grief for her, for sure. But I also felt a real sadness for the boys and for what that whole community lost, but in a way also gained, you know, as a result of this tragedy, right? The understanding mm-hmm. that has come. So I think, you know, what's happened over the years, because I've spent so many years in India, because I've made several films in India, and I've, you know, my last film was also about, you know, gender justice and women's rights. I think for me, the anger that used to fuel my earlier work, you know, that sort of rage, mm-hmm. you know, where I just was so angry, that's gone. And I think for me, what is more important now is to actually try to understand why we do what we do and what are the systems that we need to overcome. You know, what are the real issues, right? It's not the plot necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's what's underlying the plot that's important. So why do people think the way they think? Because, you know, for me, those boys, of course, what they did was wrong, and I'm not apologizing for them at all. But I also see them as a product of the culture, as a product of that system. They were taught from boyhood that they could do whatever they wanted. that there would be no repercussions, you know, that boys would be boys. It was something that they were taught. So it feels in a way that the entire society is at fault.
And we hear it time and time again. And some people watching might be surprised that even if you think and you know that people may think this way in all over the world, that they would say it so boldly out loud. And one of those times that certainly stopped me as I was watching is when the defense attorney, obviously you know that she will be defending her clients, but she's not speaking about the legalities of the case. You know, she says, why was this girl alone with the boys? Why was she out at night? Similar to what the villagers were saying. But she even goes further and says, you know, this is here. This isn't the West. I can't even trust my own son. It sounds like you weren't necessarily surprised that people were saying this out loud.
No, not at all. You know, I'm so glad you brought that up, right? Because it actually shows, I mean, the fact that it's a defense attorney, an educated, you know, upper middle class lawyer who's saying this. I mean, you know, it shows you how deeply entrenched those ideas are and how deeply entrenched they are in all of the systems, right? It's not just the village culture, but, you know, the legal system, the familial system. So she did surprise me, actually. Just the comment of like implicating her son, that surprised me. But that attitude of, you know, women should watch out, it's a woman's fault, it's her responsibility, that doesn't surprise me at all. I've been hearing it since I was a child.
You are listening to As It Happens. I'm Neil Kirksall, and this is a feature conversation with filmmaker Nisha Pahuja. She's based in Toronto and in studio with me right now. She's here to talk about her Oscar-nominated documentary, To Kill a Tiger. And Nisha, I wonder if there were times where you felt that the family was going to drop this case, because you certainly feel that tension watching this film, particularly when the activists are being strict with Ranjit, telling him he cannot miss court. He has to show up.
There were definitely times when I thought he would. I thought he would drop it. But I also knew, like, I was privy to things that the activists weren't necessarily privy to, right? I knew the financial burden. I knew how difficult it was, you know? So I don't know if they understood all of that. So, but yes, I mean, the pressure was so immense. I mean, he was threatened, you know,
threatened with death,
right? So, of course, and it wouldn't have surprised me had he dropped the case. And we certainly talked to him about it a lot, you know, to say to him, you mustn't feel like you failed if you choose not to go forward. You have to do what you feel is best for you and your family. And whatever you decide, we will support you.
What was that day like at the courthouse? What do you remember about the day where he's there, Ranjit is there, and the three accused walk by?
That was intense. I remember his face, and I remember his body, and I remember feeling how inside, you know, that sort of coiled, like all of this emotion and, you know, like the rage, you know, that frustration, that kind of desire to hurt and to harm. I remember thinking that must all be playing inside of him.
There's also this community leader and ward member in your film, Mutalik. He's interesting to watch from the get-go, riding on his motorcycle, aviator sunglasses. He certainly has a lot of opinions on the case as well. When you talk about that sense of community, and it's said in the film, you know, it's about more than one person. But at the same time, he also makes a point of saying, you know, why should I be bothered? Who are they to me? Who are you to ask me? How did you feel about him as you followed him and his arc through the film?
I loved him. I really loved him. He was such an interesting person. I wish we had more time to spend with him, because he was... And Ranjit knew this, right? I mean, Ranjit has known him for years. Like, he's the kind of person, you know, his bark is bigger than his bite kind of thing,
he's
right?
Not necessarily lovable, people might say. You've seen more of him than we have, but...
Yes. Yeah, no, he's definitely flawed and problematic. But in the end, he did the right thing, right? In the end, he showed up. And Ranjit knew he was going to. And yes, he played those horrific power games that we see. But he showed up. And he also, I think he said some things that were really critical, you know. He said at one point when he's really angry at the NGO, and he's right, like if something happens to them, it's him that has to deal with it, right? Is the NGO is the NGO going to protect them? So I think he took that responsibility also very seriously. You know, for me, one of the things that was really critical was an arc, right? And so to include that moment of him at the end of the film where he says the boys were wrong, and so of course they should be punished, but they were all children from my village, and that's why I feel sad. And I thought that was really, you know, that was a really important, was an important thing to give him, for an audience to know that he knew that it was wrong. Everybody did. The fathers of the boys, the mothers of the whole community knew that it was wrong. They knew that what had happened to her was not the right thing, right? Mm-hmm. It was that they didn't want the boys to be punished.
There is a resolution in the case quite dramatically, but it is still in the legal system, is it, to this day?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So the case is now, it's at the High Court. And as far as I know, I mean, I think I checked with Ranjit a couple of weeks ago about where it was at, and it hasn't moved. So it's not even been looked at. You know, it's been sitting there for a few years now, which is not surprising.
What has happened to the boys?
They're
now men?
They're in prison.
I want to get people's reaction to the film. You talked about what the family, how they felt and how they were beaming. What about Mubarak?
Yeah. Well, you know, it was, I showed the film. I took the film to India 6 months ago just to kind of do stress test screenings, you know, mm-hmm. just to see, make sure that it was going to be okay and it was okay for me to show the film. And so I showed it to various people who were part of it, including, you know, the ward member. I was really nervous about showing it to him. I thought he was just going to hate it. Thought he was going to be really angry with me. And he loved the film. And he said that after he watched it, he was ashamed of himself. Mm. And he couldn't believe, you know, the strength of the family. And he felt that people in the community needed to see the film so they could see what they had put the family through. Unexpected, completely unexpected, and amazing response from him.
What do you think it was about seeing it that way? What was revealed to him?
Empathy. Mm. It's empathy. And I think that is there in all of us, right? The ability to have empathy.
Have other village members seen it now? Have you heard?
Not yet. Mm. We are going to do, definitely we are going to do screenings with the community for sure.
We talked about the Protection of Children from Sexual Offences Act in India. You've also been working with Equality Now on a campaign. What can you tell us about that work?
Equality Now sees this film, they see this film obviously as a really strong kind of success case, and they feel that it could help to strengthen laws in other countries around the world around rape and sexual assault. And I think they advocate for change in gender justice through laws, you know, mm-hmm. through legal reform. So this is it's a really great fit for them. And then I think, you know, the other thing that we want to do collectively, Equality Now, myself, and then other organizations that we're working with, is we want to, again, you know, it's the idea of the systems that survivors have to navigate. So how do we sensitize those systems? How do we have screenings where people feel, you know, what it is to survive, like what a family goes through, you know, in their pursuit of justice? It's so important, I think. And then for me, the real critical piece, again, it goes back to like masculinity. It's how do we convince men that they need to stand with women, you know, that they are part, they're the missing piece. You know, we can change laws, we can keep advocating, women can keep fighting. But if they don't change and if they don't understand that the system of patriarchy is something that is oppressive for all of us, and they don't join in the struggle and they don't see this as a human rights issue, not a women's rights issue, nothing's going to change. So for me, that's the other thing that I really want this film to do, is to encourage men to join us.
You have a long list of executive producers with boldface names, certainly just two of them, Dev Patel, Mindy Kaling, that our listeners may recognize, certainly their work. What was the value or importance for you of having people in those positions and those high profile names as you made this film?
Yeah. You know, like if you look at the state of documentary and if you look at how hard it is to make long form documentaries anymore that are about social, political, cultural issues that are important, it's really tough. And to get them out there is even harder. And I knew after I made the film, it was sort of like a rough cut, and I'd gone to India and I was sort of showing it to people, and everyone said, no one's going to see this. It's great, but no one's going to watch it. And I thought to myself, my God, if I can't get people in India to watch it, how am I going to get anyone to see this story? And it's so important. And it was at that moment that I realized the only way I'm going to get this film out is if I bring on people that have power.
And did you know them? Did you just email them? What?
One of my friends is Atul Gawande. I don't know if you know Atul. He's a public health policy advocate under Biden, and he's a writer. He wrote a book called Being Mortal. Mm. And Atul is, he knows Mindy. So he reached out to Mindy, and then through other friends of mine, we reached out to Dev, and they both said yes.
And have they been helping to amazing. Promote it?
Amazing. Yeah, they're amazing. They both do, you know, what they can. So mm-hmm. Mindy's really amazing, and she's very active on social media, and she's like, you know, proud mom of the film. And Dev is incredible. Mm-hmm. Comes to screenings, talks to the press. He's really great.
Let's bring it back to the people central in your film, the family, Kieran in particular. How is she doing now?
Oh, she's really good.
What did she say when you told her about the Oscars?
Over the moon. She kind of like screamed and was so ecstatic. We have a young woman on the ground, Prithana, who was, you know, sort of like speaking to them around the time of nominations just to see how they were doing. And Ranjit, he said such a beautiful thing. She called him and he said, well, I don't really know what the Oscars are, but I know they're a big deal. And I'm really glad this happened. And she said, you know, what do you think? What does it mean to you? And he said that for him, it means, oh, so beautiful. He said, for him, it means it's about casting light onto darkness. It's about illuminating an issue. And he wanted to thank his daughter for giving him the courage to stay the course. So beautiful. Yeah.
That's quite moving. I heard that she wants to be a police officer, at least for now. Is that what you told me?
Well, you know, it's so funny. Like, for a long time she did, and then a few months ago she changed her mind again, and then again she's back at it, you know, so she...
The world is open to her.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Nisha, it's a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
You too. Thank you so much.
That's Canadian-Indian filmmaker Nisha Pahuja. She joined Neil recently in the As It Happens studio here in Toronto to talk about her documentary, To Kill a Tiger, which is nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. To Kill a Tiger is free to stream on the National Film Board of Canada's website. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.